Questions? Okay. Of course, a reminder about getting your draft reports to me with the proper names, because if I'm going to get the draft reports that you have to referee to you, I rely on all of the files being named appropriately, or else they go missing. So, of course, referees' reports themselves, what you are asked to do is to go through the other group's paper and to describe the difficulties that you see with that paper. The goal of having you referee a group's paper that you have not analyzed the data is hoping that you would recognize those things that you don't understand at all, whereas if you had analyzed the data, then you might know the answer and forget to look to see if they had written them. So that's the whole reason why I do two different projects. Then there's the further hope that if you look at their paper and say, they never told you this fact that you'd like to know, you would also look back at your paper and say, did you tell anybody that? So whether or not the other group had that problem or not, you would like to identify the problems in yours. This should be submitted as a separate Word document named appropriately back to me, and then I will get it to the groups. There's no particular format that you have to follow as you do these referees' reports. The goal is to be helpful. There is no particular advantage in being cruel, so I would urge you not to be. There's plenty of time for that later in your life when you're refereeing other papers. Cannot do that. The major way these referees' reports are used by me is if I get a paper that I then look at and I think is, when I'm looking at the final thing, has major, major problems, I then go back at the referees' reports and see if that was identified. And if major, major problems weren't identified by the referees' group, then that starts counting. But for the most part, the referees' reports are barely glanced at by me. So it's really more for the purpose of the other group. Again, all of the goal of this is to have the papers absolutely perfect as I read them, because that makes my life easy. So, questions on that? Okay, questions on anything else? Okay, well, we're talking about what to do with correlated data. And this correlated data can be just a convenience, in which case the correlation is just a nuisance parameter. And if the correlation is just a nuisance parameter, sometimes the easiest approach to deal with it is to just reduce all the data for each individual cluster to a single measurement. And then the analyses can be based on standard methods for independent data. But in those cases that you really have a question that is related to how things change within an individual, obviously this won't work, particularly on those times where you have a time-varying covariate. You're wanting to compare the outcomes on individuals who smoke and those who don't smoke, but you have data on the same individual sometimes when they're smoking and sometimes when they aren't smoking. That's what we call a time-varying covariate. At different times during the study, that covariate has different values for that patient. And so if you're really wanting to make the greatest use of those time-varying covariates, collapsing all the measurements down to one will not cut it for you. We do it sometimes just the same, in which case I might both average what the lung function is on the individuals and average the amount of time they're smoking and end up doing an ecologic study. An ecologic study is one in which you've lost the information within your subject about the relationships between the individual variables over time or over space, but that you are looking for trends. And in epidemiology, there's something that's known as the ecologic fallacy, that is, an association that you find at the cluster level data doesn't hold inside the clusters. Classic example of this is nylon stockings and lung cancer incidence, is that if you went many years ago and analyzed countries' cancer rates according to their sales of nylon stockings, you found that those countries that sold the most nylon stockings had the highest lung cancer rates. If you went to each individual country at that time, you would have largely found that the people who were wearing the nylon stockings were less likely to get lung cancer because they were women, and smoking at that time was much more prevalent in men. So that's what an ecologic fallacy was, is that this association that you saw at the country level did not hold within countries very well at all. So anytime you're going to collapse data in the presence of time-varying covariates that you have to average those exposures, then you can have this ecological fallacy. It's usually that term is usually applied at a country level or county level or something like that, but it applies just as well at a personal level. In the beta-carotene data, looking at vitamin E, subjects were randomized to 5 dose groups, measurements at baseline after 3 and 9 months of treatment, and after 3 months of stopping treatment. How do plasma beta-carotene levels change over time within dose groups? This is effect modification between dose and time, because at baseline, all the groups should be equal. You could reduce data to a single measurement on each subject, taking the difference between follow-up and baseline. Then consider the average of differences. No change corresponds to a difference of 0. You could look at the ratio between follow-up and baseline. Consider the average of ratios. No change corresponds to a ratio of 1. We've done such analyses. In the somatosensory evoked potential measurements on healthy adults, we had measurements of nerve conduction time. There were 4 separate peaks for each leg of each subject. We had 8 different measurements on each subject. We could reduce data to a single measurement. Consider only 1 peak on 1 leg. You'd have to decide which leg. You could average measurements across all the peaks in the legs, but it would only generalize to similar averages. And since we were trying to find a normal range for SEP measurements, then we'd have to reproduce how those measurements were, and you'd have to say, and what would you do if we averaged across the right and left legs on somebody who didn't have a leg? What would be the appropriate measurement? And then there'd be lots of other choices, differences between peaks, although those don't really make too much sense this study night. So how do you analyze matched continuous data? Well, comparing means, there's the paired t-test. We compute differences for each pair, do a 1 sample test that the mean difference is 0. We've already done this. The mean difference is the difference of means, so we get the same answer for the population model, the marginal model, and the within subject. There, of course, may be inherent confounding effect modification. And we have to look at, as we are looking at measurements, for instance, what does the measurement mean as I take the difference? Am I measuring the difference in age? Am I measuring the difference in elapsed time? Or am I measuring differences in birth year cohort effects that can be hard to separate out, even though I'm just still taking these differences? To compare geometric means, I do the paired t-test on log transform data. I've done this as well. A very simple alternative test to the paired t-test, which compares means, is to test whether the median of the difference is 0. If the median of the differences is 0, we would expect as many differences to be above 0 as below 0. There are those who argue that the differences that are exactly 0 do not contribute much information, and so let's just throw them out. And so that is done in the sign test. Of course, the median difference, we can compute the difference of the observations and then consider whether those differences tend to be negative or positive. And properties of the median difference is that the median difference is not the difference in medians. 2 simple data sets, 1, 3, 10 and 2, 5, 10. The median of y minus the median of x is 5 minus 3, which is 2. but the difference 1, 2, and 0, and the median difference is 1. It's also not transitive by the very nature of its comparison, so that if you find that treatment A is better than treatment B is better than treatment C, it is possible to find that treatment C is better than treatment A. Sign test elevator statistics, just the proportion positive among non-zero differences. And so it's just a one sample binomial test. In Stata, there's a command sign test that you just say variable one equals variable two. It gives you one-sided, two-sided p-values. It doesn't give you estimates or confidence intervals. You can do this on your own using BiTest if you want it. In the Stata, beta-carotene data, we could test to see whether caret 3 is equal to caret 0. Gives me the observed expected. And then does the one-sided and two-sided tests. And note that because of the discrete nature, the one-sided and two-sided tests have to take into account the ties. And so you can't just add the one-sided and two-sided p-values. And can't just add the two different one-sided p-values and get one. The interpretation, we can't with 95% confidence reject the null hypothesis that the median change in plasma beta-carotene levels after 9 months of treatment was zero. And that's about all you can say.
Question?
Yes?
Did you say you get CI using BiTest?
Well, you know, you can get confidence intervals on that, but because you've thrown out the zeros to do the sign test, you've treated them as non-informative, which is not something that I'm convinced you should do. But because of that, you know, it's not clear what it is that you're, what proportion you're estimating. Right?
I was just confused because I thought we were talking about continuous data and I thought my test.
But we've dichotomized it.
Okay.
We've dichotomized it. We've taken the differences and then we just say whether they're positive or negative, like I had you do on the homework with a couple of them. You were actually doing these tests. I had a long discussion with my daughter as to whether we definitely agreed that McNamara's test, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, that those words should go away, that there's no reason to ever use the word McNamara's test because it is just the sign test. But I was pushing removing the sign test from our vocabulary entirely and just using the paired t-test. She was arguing the opposite, which just goes to show that no matter how smart I am, I just couldn't teach my children. Well, but the sign test does have applications in the idea of people talking about the median of a continuous random variable. But, you know, and testing that it's equal to some particular value, but I just prefer talking about the proportion that's above that threshold instead. Sign test is simple to perform, ignores a lot of information. You might expect that there's some information in the magnitude of the differences. So if, in fact, as we took the difference, 50 were negative and 50 were positive, but the 50 that were negative were all negative 0.01, and the 50 that were positive ranged between 100 and 300, you might say that there was a tendency to be larger. And so the signed rank test is something that takes into account not only how many are positive or negative, but also which ones tend to be larger in absolute value. The null hypothesis of the Wilcoxon sign rank test is that the number of positive and negative differences should tend to be equal, and there should be no tendency for the positive differences to be further from or closer to zero than the negative differences. So the basic approach, you compute the differences, you rank the absolute value, you sum up the ranks of the positive differences, and under null hypothesis of equality of distributions, the sampling distribution should be the same as randomly choosing n over two numbers from the integers 1 to n. So we cannot just take the differences and the absolute values and then count them as two different groups and then do the Wilcoxon rank sum test, because the Wilcoxon rank sum test will take into account different sample sizes. And this test presumes that the sample sizes should be equal. So the Wilcoxon sign rank test does have to be done by itself. You can't. So the example of the signed ranks, I have X, I have Y, I have my differences. The ranks of the numbers are ranked according to the absolute value. The sum of the positive ranks, the sum of the positive ranks is 21. There were four positive ranks, and in this case, there were four negative ranks. What summary measure are they testing? There is one that can be described. It's not easily explained. Can be significant either because the number of positive differences is unusually high or the mean positive difference is high. Some sort of balance between the two. A significant signed rank test can only be interpreted as a difference in the distributions. Standard error of the test statistics based on a permutation distribution. It's only testing equality of distributions, and it is not a consistent test of arbitrary differences between the distributions. So what we want in a consistent test is if there were a difference between the distributions with an infinite sample size, you'd get a statistically significant result. You're not promised to do that. And that's true of almost every test we use, that you're not promised to find out about every difference. The t-test, we'd only find out if there's a difference in the means. Test of medians, we'd only find out if there's a difference in the medians, and so on. The difference here is that it uses a distribution, a type 1 error, that is only correct if the distributions are exactly equal. Stata, you have sign rank, provides one-sided and two-sided p-values, and again, no estimates or confidence intervals. So looking at caret 3 versus caret 0 with the sign rank test, and we get a p-value of 0.0280. So more significant than was in the sign test. This does not mean go and do them both and choose the one you like, but it does mean that the sign rank test will tend to be more precise at finding differences than will the sign test. The sign test you stand a chance of doing on an elevator. The sign rank test you probably don't stand a chance of doing on an elevator. Maybe your smartphones can do it. I don't have a smartphone. So we can with 95% confidence reject the null hypothesis. There was no systematic trend towards increasing or decreasing plasma beta carotene levels after 9 months of treatment with placebo. What about comparing proportions in matched samples? Sometimes we're looking at a binary outcome, but we have a crossover study. So relief of headaches from aspirin versus Tylenol. Each subject receives each treatment, but in random order. In ophthalmology studies, we sometimes look at treating the two eyes differently and then make comparisons within each subject in terms of a binary outcome. As we present the data, if we had independent groups, we tended to organize our data into a 2x2 table as response versus treatment and the new versus placebo. But we have correlated data in this case, and so usually we reorganize this data to find out what the concordance is, and so we present our data with response on placebo versus response on new. And our concordant cases are in the diagonal that has A and D. There were A's out of N subjects who responded on both treatments. There were D out of N subjects who responded on neither treatment. How much do those subjects tell you about differences between the treatments? there are many people who say they tell you nothing. And so let's not even count them. And let's just look at the B and C, the discordant pairs. And if the two treatments worked equally, what would you expect the numbers B and C to be? Well, equal to each other. We'd expect that the sum total of B plus C, 50%, would have worked on the new treatment, but not placebo, and 50% would have worked on placebo, not the new treatment, if the treatments were equal. So that's what McNamara's test does. So a difference of proportions would be B minus C over N. It's the usual estimate. Two different ways we could analyze the data. The least frequently used is compare the proportion with response in each group, taking matching into account. It's analogous to the paired t-test. It's a valid test in large samples. I truly think this is the better test to use. There's no reason to use McNamara's test. However, McNamara's test is most often used. We focus on the discord with pairs only. It's awfully hard to get these two tests to disagree. Till beyond the third digit in the p-value. So, and I personally would trust the paired t-test a little bit more to be answering what I personally cared about. But. So if the response were equal in the two groups, discordant pairs should be equally likely to be in either order. We condition on the number of discordant pairs. And under the null hypothesis, discordant pairs should be equally likely to be B or C. Just a one sample test of a binomial proportion. So we test the hypothesis that B is binomially distributed with sample size B plus C and probability 0.5. Stata gives you exact McNamara's. I can look at the prevalence of edema versus ascites in liver data. Are ascites and edema equally prevalent? But of course, I'm measuring this all on the same people. So it's correlated data. So I have a table. And I do a bi-test immediate where I had 27 discordant pairs. I look at the probability that one of them would just be 7 if the probability were 0.5. And this does the exact McNamara's test. We find a two-sided p-value of 0.0192, suggesting that these two are not equally prevalent. Could be based on the asymptotic distribution, where we use the normal approximation. Stata uses asymptotic theory, MCC, matched case control. Cases and controls gives two-sided p-values and provides confidence interval for the difference in proportions. So again, prevalence of edema versus ascites in liver data, p-value 0.0124. So the asymptotics agree fairly well. And then we get the confidence interval for the difference in proportions. We can compare the paired t-test. Had we just tested that edema was equal to ascites, we get nearly the same results. So I visualize a day when people will be free of having to remember the words McNamara's test. It just, it's doing the same thing as the paired t-test. One thing that you might consider is the difference between the chi-square test and the McNamara's test. If I do McNamara's test, I'm answering the question, are ascites and edema equally prevalent? Okay, not a really important scientific question to answer, I'll confess. If I do the chi-square test, I'm saying, does the prevalence of ascites differ between subjects with and without edema? So two separate questions. McNamara's test is not a test that we use nearly as often as we use the chi-square test. McNamara's test is just the sign test. It's a more general description of the procedure. I prefer using that name even when using binary data. I just had to tell you what McNamara's test was. gray hair? Is gray matter extravasated through your follicles? And thus, I assure you, my brain is full. So now we're going to talk simple regression. Simple regression means you're doing regression on a single variable. Of course, we've been talking about this all along in discussion section, but we've also been talking about multiple regression in discussion section. But what I want to do is talk about the general regression setting and then the four simple regression models that we use most often. And then I probably will not, before the end of the quarter, get very substantially into these additional comments about inference. But they're in here. So what is the general regression setting? Well, there's the two-variable setting that we've been primarily dealing with in lectures. We have a response variable, and we have a grouping variable. Our goal is to compare the distribution of the response variable across groups that are defined by the grouping variable. Within each group, the value of the grouping variable is constant. In most introductory courses, we characterize statistical analyses by the number of samples, the number of groups that we're comparing, and whether subjects in the groups are independent. And heretofore, then, we have talked so far about one sample tests and two sample tests. And we've talked about two sample tests with independent data and two sample tests with matched data. So this correspondence with the two-variable setting, if the grouping variable is constant, if everybody has the exact same value, that's what we call the one-sample problem. If that grouping variable is binary, like sex, it's the two-sample problem. We have males, we have females. If it's categorical, like race, we have the k-sample problem. And if it's continuous, it's what I call the infinite sample problem, and that's regression. The idea is, if we look at age, so I want to look at FEV by age, how many different groups do I have? Well, I have as many different groups as there are different ages in the population. And if I measure that very precisely, there's an infinite number of them. So look at blood pressure versus age. It's a scatter plot from the CHS dataset. Regression extends one and two sample statistics, i.e. the t-test, to the infinite sample problem. We don't really ever have or care about an infinite number of samples. But it's easiest to use models that would allow that in order to handle continuous predictors of interest or adjustment for other variables. So we can use regression lots of places that we don't have to, but there are some places that we have to. When used with a binary grouping variable, common regression models reduce to the corresponding two-variable methods. Linear regression with a binary predictor, if we're using the classical linear regression, that's the t-test with equal variance. If I use the robust option to get the robust standard errors, that's approximately the t-test with unequal variance. If I do logistic regression with a binary predictor, the score test from logistic regression is the chi-squared test for association. If I do Cox regression, proportional hazard regression, with a binary predictor, the score test is the log-rank test. We've already used that as we wanted to get inference for the hazard ratio between two groups. The log-rank statistic output didn't give us any estimate, but we could use the regression to get that. And so this comes to the guiding principle, and this comes from when I offered to take my biostat and stat 570 students for beer or whatever, and I couldn't make it until 5 o'clock, and they went there substantially earlier. One of them, as I showed up finally, was then lit enough that he came up and said, well, you know what we make fun of you for is, don't you? And this was one of the things that he made fun of me for. I'll say there were some other things that I related to my sister over the phone. And I told her one phrase, and then I said, and apparently there's a hand gesture that goes with that. She goes, yes, I know what it is. So. So we have different types of variables. We have binary data, nominal data, ordinal categorical data, quantitative data. We have right-censored data. We summarize the distributions of the populations that might vary according to the type of data we have. So means we can use for binary data and quantitative data. Medians we can use for any ordered data, quantitative, censored data. Proportions, odds, hazards. Hazards we truly can use for any sort of data. When it comes to studying for the final, of course, you can go back to old finals. They're all posted. The one final that I've given in my life that I liked the best was the one from 2007, where on that I was asking the students out of the blue, you guys have now been forewarned, that I did the log rank test and the proportional hazards on uncensored data. And I said, what does this mean? You know, but the key point is we can do hazard analysis on uncensored data. We just don't. And we don't for good reasons. Nobody understands it. So that's the concept is. We truly could do it on other things. Our regression models are named according to the parameter that's compared across groups. When we're comparing means, we call that linear regression. Geometric means, well, that's linear regression on log transform data. We compare odds, that's logistic regression. Rates, Poisson regression. Hazards, proportional hazards regression. Quantiles, okay, we have others too, but parametric survival regression is one area where we are comparing quantiles of distributions across groups. So the general notation that we have is we have some response variable y, we have some predictor x, and our parameter that we're trying to compare, so the summary measure that we're using for our inference, I'll just call theta. And that theta might be the mean, the geometric mean, the odds, the rate, the hazard, or truly anything that somebody somewhere has dreamed up and decided to do. Okay? So that's the key thing of all of this regression analysis is people all the time come up with bizarre regression analyses that I have no idea why they came up with it or what they're doing. But ultimately, at the end of the day, they write down their model, what it was. I trust them that they're truly estimating the thing that they want, and now I know how to do inference. And that's all that's needed. So in simple regression, we have that g of theta, g, we call that a link function, is equal to beta 0 plus beta 1 times x. That's just the equation for a straight line. Beta 0, we call the intercept of the linear predictor. So that beta 0 plus beta 1 times x, we just call the linear predictor. And beta 1 is the slope. And as we get into multiple regression, we would further quantify. That's the slope for predictor x of the linear predictor. Dealing with me in general regression is far easier. Because while software will tell you about all sorts of different link functions you can use, I only like two of them. So one of them is to use no link function whatsoever, or the mathematicians would say, oh, that's the identity link function. Okay? That's just that, you know, the function that maps x onto x, that's the identity function. So that does an additive model. That looks at differences in theta between groups that differ by a unit in x. This is the most common link to use when analyzing means of continuous y. The geometric mean, the odds, the rates, and hazards tend to be used in a multiplicative model. We'd look at odds ratios, geometric mean ratios, hazard ratios, odds ratios. Those can be phrased as using log of theta follows a straight line. In In doing regression, we're doing two things. We're using other groups to make estimates in groups with sparse data. Intuitively, if I don't have very many 68-year-olds, I can use 67 and 69-year-olds to help me guess what the 68-year-olds would have been doing. Assuming a straight line relationship tells us how to adjust data from other, even more distant age groups. And we've talked about this a lot in discussion sections, where we are saying, you know, we don't have all that many smokers, and we want to compare smokers to non-smokers of the same age and height, and by presuming a straight line relationship across the different age and height groups, we can find out how to estimate a comparable group for every smoker. If we don't know the exact functional relationship, we might want to borrow information only close to each group. Next quarter, you'll talk a little bit about splines. It's the moral equivalent of using like a low S curve or something, but it's not exactly the low S curve that you're using. Of course, we also use our regression model to define contrasts. How is it that we're comparing the response across groups? Well, if there's a straight line relationship in the parameter, then the slope is the difference in the parameter between groups that differ by 1 year in X. If nonlinear relationship in the parameter, the slope is some sort of average difference in the parameter between groups differing by 1 year in X. In statistical jargon, we call this a contrast. So anything that's just a difference across the groups is a contrast. A little bit more to it than this. But the idea, if there's a nonlinear relationship, we're still often quite happy in talking about the linear trend. Usual example I give, if it takes me 3 hours to drive to Portland, my slope is 60 miles per hour. I'm not going 60 miles per hour every instant, but that's an average. It's a weighted average of the speeds that I have. Next quarter, we'll talk about multiple regression. And we've talked about multiple regression in discussion section because we wanted to adjust for both age and height when we were analyzing smoking. But it's a quite straightforward generalization. Now our linear predictor is beta 0 plus beta 1 times x1 plus beta 2 times x2 plus on up to beta p times xp. And p is an extremely common notation to use for the number of predictors you have in your model. And again, now our beta j is the slope for predictor x sub j of the linear predictor. Everything else stays the same. Uses of multiple regression, we model complex scientific factors. For instance, smoking I often model with up to four different variables where I might look at an indicator of whether they've ever smoked, an indicator of whether they're currently smoking, their pack years, the years since quitting, and so on. I might use this to model U-shaped trends. I talk a lot about the U-shaped trend in our CHS data set that is the relationship between serum cholesterol levels and the risk of death. That it's not a straight line relationship. Turns out to be people with very low cholesterols die soon. People with high cholesterols die soon. People with intermediate cholesterols, which in that data set is a surprisingly high intermediate cholesterol at around 280. They have the lowest risk of death as estimated from a U-shaped trend. We can model each groups independently by putting in multiple indicator variables. An indicator variable for black race, Asian race, Pacific Islanders, so on. We also use the multiple regression to adjust for cooked fits, which adjustment might be because of confounding, or it might be because we want to gain precision. We also use this to model effect modification by including interaction terms. The major difference between regression methods is just the interpretation of the parameters. Which summary measure we're using, is it the mean, the geometric mean, the odds, the hazard, and how are we comparing the groups? Is it the difference or the ratio? The issues related to inclusion of covariates remain the same. It really doesn't matter. You're still thinking about effect modification, predictor of interest, addressing confounding, and increasing precision. So it's truly just thinking about regression in its general sense is the most useful thing. And then you get down to some little details that are a little bit different between linear regression, logistic regression, proportional hazards regression, and so on. Usual regression output contains an estimate of the intercept. It'll be the estimated g of theta when all predictors are zero. There will be a slope of each predictor. The estimated difference in g of theta for two groups that differ by one unit in the corresponding predictor and agree in all other modeled predictors, all other predictors that are in the model. There will be standard errors for those estimates. There will be confidence intervals. And then almost all software I know of gives you p-values testing for an intercept of zero. And that's because it's just as easy to do that as to not do anything, although perhaps they should not do anything. It's usually unimportant. And then the slope of zero. This is usually our test for association and theta. And remember that if g of theta is the log of theta, testing that log of theta is zero, so that the slope is zero, is equivalent to testing that it's exponentiated equal to 1. The ratio is 1. So if we use an identity link, so I say that theta of y given x is beta 0 plus beta 1 times x. This is the most commonly used when theta is a mean, so it's linear regression. Intercept is the value of theta for a group with x equals 0, so in linear regression, beta 0 is the mean value of y when x equals 0. Usually not of its scientific interest because it's out of the range of the data. Possibly it's even impossible. The slope, beta 1, is the difference in theta across groups differing in x by one unit. I call it the average difference just on the chance that it might not be a straight line relationship. And so in linear regression, it's the average difference in means between two groups that differ in one. This is usually our measure of association between y and x. If I use the log link, so now log of theta is equal to beta 0 plus beta 1 times x. And now my interpretations. The intercept. Exponentiate the intercept, and that's the value of theta for a group with x equals 0. Exponentiate slope, and that's some sort of an average ratio of theta across groups differing x by 1. Most common examples, well, if I do linear regression on log of y, then theta is the geometric mean, and e to the beta 1 is the geometric mean ratio. Logistic regression, e to the beta 1 is the odds ratio. Proportional hazards regression, e to the beta 1 is the hazard ratio. Regression analysis is commonly used to answer statistical questions of three types. Estimating the distribution parameters in the population, that's sometimes done. Comparing distributions across groups, that's the major thing we use it for. We also sometimes use it to predict future individual observations. Why do we do that type 4 question the most? It needs the fewest assumptions. So the assumptions needed for valid inference are just like the assumptions that we've been using for the t-test, right? Approximate normality of the estimated slopes, correct modeling of the dependence among observations, correct modeling of the variance within groups. So those are exactly the same assumptions we would need for doing the t-test. And they hold in all these forms of regression, although that correct modeling of variance within groups, there are some asterisks that I have to put on that when it comes to logistic regression and proportional hazards. But this really holds quite generally. If I'm going to use my linear predictor to estimate theta, so I'm not just trying to say, does age have a relationship with blood pressure? But I'm really trying to say, what is the average blood pressure among people who are 45 years old? Then, if I'm going to use that, I need the additional assumption that the straight line relationship holds. And if I'm going to go all the way to try to predict future values of y, What is the blood pressure of the next person who walks in this room that's 45 years old? I also need to understand the distribution of Y among all of those 45-year-olds. But these assumptions just go straight in line with what we've been talking about in the two sample tests. So a motivating example, what's the association between blood pressure and age? A scientific question might be, does aging affect blood pressure? We can't answer that because I don't know how to randomize people to age. So it has to be an observational study. So my statistical question, does the distribution of systolic blood pressure differ across age groups? There's variability of response, but I'm uncertain of the cause and effect. The differences could be related to calendar time of birth. Everybody who I have is 45 may have had the same blood pressure since the day they were born. I don't know. So I have a response that's a continuous variable, that's systolic blood pressure. My predictor of interest is age. It's continuous. An infinite number of ages are possible. We probably don't sample every one of them. Linear regression is most often used with a continuous response variable and continuous predictor of interest, or any predictor of interest adjusted for other variables. It makes perfect sense with a binary predictor of interest. I could look at pressure by age using regression. I mean, by sex using regression. I could even, if I wanted to, use a binary response, although this is non-standard. I suspect it's going to start being a little bit more standard. So we look for linear trends in average blood pressure by age. Association will exist if the slope beta 1 is non-zero. In that case, average blood pressure will be different across different age groups. So here's the scatter plot. I put on the low S curve and the least squares line. Regression model produces something similar to a rule of thumb. Normal blood pressure is 100 plus half your age. Yeah, I learned that at one time. Not quite accurate. When I actually do my least squares fit, I find out it's 98.9, it's 0.431 times age. But this idea is there. It's just giving me some sort of an estimate of approximately what's true. And this is this data output. We've looked at this before as we've talked about correlation. So the regression model serves to make estimates in groups with sparse data by borrowing information. It also defines a comparison across groups by estimating the slope. So this is just the slide we've seen before. Intuitively, we're gaining more information about 68-year-olds by using 67 and 69-year-olds. But our contrast, our slope, is interpretable as the difference in mean blood pressure between groups differing by 1 year in age. The regression output provides the estimates, the estimated mean when age equals zero, the slope, the estimated difference in average blood pressure for two groups differing by 1 year in age. We get standard errors, we get confidence intervals, and we get the intercept of zero, the test for that, and the slope of zero, the test for that. And now this is specific to means. And our interpretation reads very much like interpretations we've been doing so far. From linear regression analysis, we estimate that for each year difference in age, the difference in mean blood pressure is 0.43 millimeters of mercury. 95% confidence interval suggests this is not unusual. If the true difference were between 0.17 and 0.69, and because the p-value is less than 0.0005, we reject the null hypothesis. There's no linear trend across age groups. So we'll go into more detail in simple linear regression on Wednesday.